to be here tonight and to all of you for welcoming me. It's quite wonderful to look out on a room full of people, one of whom I know well, my partner Nancy. Or she says I don't know her well when I ask, but I know her better than most people here. And a few others that I met just briefly this afternoon. And to realize that you really are, not metaphorically, but truly my brothers and sisters in the Dharma, and also brothers and sisters in this mysterious and very challenging phenomenon called human birth. 2,500 years ago, Siddhartha Gautama awakened. Something really remarkable happened to him, because we're here tonight as a result of what happened to him. That's a long time. Depending on how you count generations, it's something between 120 and 150 generations. So my teachers, 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 etc., and yours have this direct person-to-person connection to a being who woke up completely. The word Buddha means awake. And in larger context than that, and this is part of what poses the dilemma for us as humans, the science folks say the planet's been here for about 4.2 billion years. Life's been around for more than 3/4 or 7/8 of that. And humans, in the last tiniest eye blink of that, with the human cranium being now dated at 100,000, maybe 2,000, 200,000 years ago. A being who was closely related, really the culmination in a way of these billions of lifetimes of evolution, had an experience where he realized that he wasn't separate from it all. He was a mammal like us who had a realization that he wasn't separate from the universe, nor was he separate from his brothers, his human brothers and sisters. And he looked around. His quest had been, what about this suffering, this incredible suffering that happens in human life? And he looked around, and what he saw was a sea of suffering. Because we get born sick, old, and die. Because we don't get what we want. We get what we don't want. We don't get to be with our loved ones and the people we'd really like to be with, or we get to be with them, those we don't want to be with. So something happened with him. And then he had 45 years or so to teach. And we're here because of that exquisite model of consciousness and consciousness development, of moral and ethical living, of teaching ourselves how to think more skillfully and how to perceive and become wise. Being fundamentally mammalian, with an overlay of, what is it, the neocortex, we have incredibly powerful instinctive energies and drives. We have a built-in, case of mistaken identification. We get born and we go what we go through what Ram Dass calls somebody training. You know, so that we get out of bed in the morning and we say, this is who I am, this is what I believe, this is my ethnic group, those are the enemies, this is, etc. Don't challenge me. And we have to do that. We have to become those who don't make it to having a separate self wind up in institutions, right? So we have to do that in some way or another. And along the way, we also get conditioned very heavily that we belong to a particular gender, with all of its benefits and detriments, that we belong to a particular family, with the same, that we belong to a particular community, ethnic group, nation. And one of the great problems with human consciousness is what the Buddha called attachment to view, attachment to our ideas. This is how it is. And we've been deeply conditioned to relate to ourselves, conditioned by our mammalian roots, and then also by the way our families are structured and society is structured and nations are structured. We've been conditioned significantly to look out for our own survival and the survival of those nearest and dearest to us. And of course, any mammal that didn't have that didn't make it. Right? Mammals that wouldn't kill to protect their loved ones didn't make it, for the most part anyway, or they were prey species. So we have this dilemma. We have this incredibly astounding capacity for consciousness that the Buddha demonstrated and then offered this path to practice. And we have this capacity to stand up and look over the horizon and look outside our beliefs and outside our identifications and to experience in our hearts compassion that the Buddha described as the sensitive heart's natural trembling in the face of suffering. And it would seem that we as humans have reached a crossroads. Either we're going to learn how to wake up and to see through the eyes of the heart and to see the suffering around us. I guess I missed a step there. We first must wake up to the suffering within ourselves. Right? That first ennobling truth, dukkha. There really is tremendous suffering in being a human. It doesn't mean it's a drab, awful, horrible thing. It's an amazing place to live, particularly as we recognize the inevitability of pain and discomfort and so on. But part of what's happened to me over now, it's almost 30 years of practice, is gradually just opening more and more to how much suffering there is in my own being, in my own life, an aging body, and then those near to me. It's not like I didn't see it, but I didn't grok it, right? I didn't let it in. I didn't acknowledge that it was real. The images that I saw on television didn't, it's like, oh, that's them over there. It always helped if they were a different color, right? Because then gradually, you know, growing up and having a family and having children, then I started noticing that those are mommies and daddies over there. And those are little babies over there. And those are their beloved children and so on. So there's one piece of the path which has to do with retreat and withdrawal and going into that incredibly quiet place where we can observe the arising and passing away of thoughts, of feelings, of mental objects, of states of consciousness. And it all just plays itself out, right? In that incredible place of Vipassana mind. And where we discover that everything is, in fact, everything is in fact, not theoretically, but is in constant, uncontrolled flux. That whenever there's grasping, whenever there's wanting anything to be different than it is, even at the level of this mood is not pleasant, there's dukkha, there's suffering. And then the core, the luminous, brilliant jewel at the heart of the Buddha's teaching, his teaching on anatta, or emptiness, that while there is something here, clearly there's something here, and we need to be great stewards for it, it's not going to be here for long. And the sense of I, that little bit that we add on in thinking, these are my thoughts, this is my body, I, me, me, mine, it becomes in the depth of our practice simply obvious, oh, that's an add-on. Because there's perception, there's seeing and hearing and smelling and tasting without a sense of self. But we're conditioned by all those things I've mentioned to add on I and me and mine. So in our formal practice, and particularly our withdrawal from the world and doing retreats and so on, this luminous training, insight, I love that. Out on the building, the word insight, how lovely. Insight into what? It's all changing. So that's very important and liberating and gives us a place to work from and helps us learn. I have a great bumper sticker on my car. It says, "Don't believe everything you think." I wish I could do that all the time. It's so easy to believe that these thoughts are mine, or these feelings are mine, moods, emotions. So then there's this other hand of practice, which is, how is it that I then come into family life, the life of work, the life of being a responsible citizen of a country, of a planet? And how do I bring the deep, I think of it like the Grand Canyon, you know, there's the central 5,000 feet, the Kaibab Plateau and down, it's a mile deep and it's narrow. And then there's this 1,000 feet deep. And then there's 4,000 feet that go out like this. They're incredibly beautiful, all these side canyons. And I think of that as the practice in daily life, that we get these enormous insights in sitting. And then how do I learn? How do I then relate to my sick parent or to my child who's in jail or my whatever? If we went around this room and talked about what it is that's heavy on our hearts tonight, it would be a rather huge pile. It would also be good to do, no doubt. And it's here that having a practice, a daily practice, calming down, keeping aware of what the mind is doing, and also then the practice of compassion. And the practice of compassion has to do with turning intentionally toward the suffering. And to do that routinely, regularly, not masochistically, not so that we blow ourselves out of the water, but to get quiet enough and then to turn toward it. Oh, there really is, there's something heavy on the heart. There's restless and agitation, or there's doubt, or there's fear, or disliking, or anger, and so on. And not making those into enemies, but of realizing that they're the stuff that connects us to each other. I mean, we're also connected fundamentally, where we're all one living, conscious, amazing universe. But we do have these separate bodies, and they're capable of enormous, wonderful good things and enormous bad, painful, awful, destructive things. So I want to share a poem with you. It's kind of a prose poem from the modern science mystic Albert Einstein. A human being is part of a whole called by us the universe, a part limited in time and in space. She experiences herself, her thoughts and feelings, as something separated from the rest, a kind of optical delusion of consciousness. This delusion is a kind of prison for us, restricting us to our personal desires and to affection for a few persons nearest to us. Our task must be to free ourselves from this prison by widening our circle of compassion to embrace all living creatures and the whole of nature in its beauty. A human being is part of a whole called by us the universe, a part limited in time and in space. He experiences himself, his thoughts and feelings, as something separated from the rest, a kind of optical delusion of consciousness. This delusion is a kind of prison for us, restricting us to our personal desires and to affection for a few persons nearest to us. Our task must be to free ourselves from this prison by widening our circle of compassion to embrace all living creatures and the whole of nature in its beauty. Can you open it? Thank you. If we want to fly loops in an airplane, it's best to choose an aerobatic kind of plane, something with short, stubby wings and lots of power. 747s don't do loops well. Right? We climb up and we dive down and then the wings just... Human beings have design limits. We can't do everything. Sometimes the suffering is so great that we go under. Sometimes the suffering is so great that we act out in very destructive, mammalian ways. And so one of the purposes of our practice is to ground us more and more deeply in our interbeing with each other and in our capacity to tolerate greater and greater suffering without flinching. As Joanna Macy, who many of you know, I'm sure, said in a workshop a few years ago and just touched me deeply, please, please do your own grieving. Do your own grieving, because if you don't, when the chips hit the fan, so to speak, you'll lash out and hurt your loved ones and other people. Right? Unless we can hold that. This, of course, has enormous ramifications for our lives with ourselves, with our children and spouses and partners and friends and so on. And there's a larger level that I've been toiling with a lot in the last few weeks. Actually, longer than that, since the September 11th disaster and the disastrous response that our nation is having. And then I get hooked. There's an addictive aspect in my character. And I have a high-speed internet connection, and I've been hooked on watching the images from the Middle East for the last 2 or 3 weeks. 2 mornings, I actually missed my morning sitting in order to watch CNN. Shows how bad it can get. But what was I seeing? I was seeing very graphic images of a family at Passover dinner blown to shreds by someone who thought he was going to heaven because he did that. I've seen a little boy, 9 years old, who was throwing a stone at a tank and received 3 or 4 large caliber machine gun bullets in the chest and head. And that's just the beginning, right? It's monstrous. I've seen little Palestinian girls, 6 years old, learning how to chant hatred chants about Israelis. I saw an interview with an American Israeli settler saying fervently, God gave us this land, and it doesn't matter whether the international community or Ariel Sharon or anybody tells us to leave. This is our land, and we'll kill anyone who tries to take it from us. Madness. Human beings attached to mistaking geography for the metaphors of the spiritual texts to begin with, but forgetting that these people on the other side are just like them, just like us. They're not different. There was one very touching, beautiful image of two fathers, a Palestinian and an Israeli father, who met. They had both lost sons. And they were embracing one another and crying and saying, how can we do this? Your son and my son are the same. Now, of course, this is not new on the planet. Right? This is normal for humans, has always been. Buddhist history in Southeast Asia has some very ugly stories of sacking and burning every 100 years into each other's countries. Tibet ruled northern China for several 100 years rather violently, etc. So there's something about us humans, just barely emerging into the large cranium and only 2,500 years ago with a Buddha, that if push comes to shove the wrong way, we go horribly unconscious. We lose the capacity to see, and we get caught up in these, the kilesas, right? The incredible passions. And we're willing to do, apparently, almost anything, really anything. I watched too much of it and didn't keep enough space and began to get depressed and sometimes angry, taking sides, watching my mind first on this side and then on that side. And I can really understand how, if that was my son, it would be a challenge. It would really be a challenge. And I was surrounded by my ethnic group that was hating the other side. It would be very challenging to say, I'm going to practice forgiveness. I wouldn't begin to have the support for my grief that I would need in order to do that. It's possible to do that. I have a friend who's traveled to South Africa a lot, and there's a couple, the Beals. Actually, Mr. Beal just died a couple of weeks ago. Their daughter was raped by 3 African men. They went to jail. The Beals visited them, became good friends with them. And 2 of these rapists now work with them in a very potent anti-rape program in South Africa. So the Beals work with the rapist. And kill her. They killed her also, yes. I missed a piece. So it's possible. We humans can do that. And humans have done it all over the planet. But there is this tendency to take sides and to identify with our hatred. There's another level of it that I struggle with in myself that I'll bet is happening here in this room as well. And that is that I know that my country, this country, the land of the free, sends $5 billion to one side of the conflict in the Middle East a year. And is not a fair arbiter. Can't do it. And there's all these political forces and nobody's in charge of that. It's just this mess of anatta going on. I also know that our country is very busy planning an attack on Iraq. I also know, or at least who knows what one knows, right? It comes from the media. But the recent New Yorker magazine had a very in-depth article on Iraq's plans to use biological and chemical weapons and preparing a nuclear weapon. And Saddam won't hesitate a minute to do it. There's these huge forces. So then again I can fall into, what do I do? I'm so hopeless, helpless. I've stopped getting responses from my senators and congressmen. I don't know whether they've stopped doing that nationally, but they don't respond. So then I get into, well, geez, here I am. I'm trying to practice the Dharma, and I'm trying to be a responsible person. What can I do? And one of the things that I'm doing is talking about it. It's kind of a topic we're not supposed to talk about generally. Or we wind up talking about it from one pole or the other. Then we get into conflict. Rather than talking about it from the direction of compassion, which is that here are our brothers and sisters involved in incredible suffering, fearing for their lives, killing one another. And of course, it's away from over. It's not near over. So actually, I had the same, it was a conversation in Portland. We have a longer time and we have people speak back and forth. And some very useful notions came up. Among them were, well, each of us is called to do something different, and that might be letter writing or going somewhere. It might be going and being a witness on the scene. It might be signing up in the military or becoming, if one were connected in that way. So each of us has to find our own way how to become peaceful with it as best we can. Peaceful and yet to not turn away from the suffering. Because we live in this wonderful, at least most of us in this room, I think, we live in splendid isolation where we lock our doors and we're quite safe. We go to work and, we decide what kind of coffee to have when we go to the... It's a very rarefied existence. But so to not turn away from the fact that there is this really heavy thing going on. And of course, we don't have to go far. There was a very degenerate alcoholic fellow who came to the door, a sweet fellow this afternoon. And he lives in East Palo Alto. I used to live in San Jose many years ago. And he described the East Palo Alto that I'd heard of then. There's enormous suffering right there. External, big suffering. I mean, we all have it in our homes and so on. But so to turn toward this as part of our intentional Dharma practice, to keep our heart open. The Sufis have a saying that the task is to learn to keep your heart open in hell. Right? Think of the monks, the Dalai Lama's physician and several others who've reported that during their torture at the hands of the Chinese, his doctor said this. The Dalai Lama asked him, "Were you ever concerned for yourself?" And his reply was, "Yes, there was once when they were torturing me, when I lost sight of the fact that they were suffering and that they were building terrible karma for themselves. They were planting terrible seeds." He lost sight of that once. Which, if we make a leap to the Christian mythology, Jesus on the cross, "Forgive them, for they know not what they do." That takes a huge heart. It takes a heart that's capable of enormous suffering. It takes a heart that can sit on a cushion and face a painful knee and not flinch. Another one of our Sangha members, important, came up, reminded me, and it's like amnesia had come in. Of course, one of the most important things we can do is to keep our meditation practice deepening and calm and be contributing a calming, loving, compassionate energy to the noosphere or the morphogenic field. That it seems that how we hold our consciousness or how we shape the consciousness has a major effect. We can't see it, but a major place that I stumble is that I want to see the outcome. I want to see positive effect. I want it to change. And then I'll get disheartened because it's not changing. It looks like it's getting worse. But how to then get together as community, as Sangha, and to practice and to bring our own suffering and the suffering of our neighbors and so on out, and then to bring up the suffering. I want to do it as a guided meditation in just a minute. To bring up the suffering of the parties involved in this particular catastrophe, human catastrophe. To remember they're human beings, they're misguided, they're blinded by lust, hatred, and ignorance, just like us. And they think what they're doing is the right thing. And so would probably any of us in their shoes. So another poem from Lao Tzu, sometime around the time of the Buddha. "Arms are instruments of ill omen. When one is compelled to use them, it is best to do so without relish. There is no glory in victory, and to glorify it despite this is to exult in the killing of people. And when great numbers of people are killed, one should weep over them with sorrow. When victorious in war, one should observe the rites of mourning. One should be sorrowful." One more connection. Paradoxically, sometimes people who don't know anything about Buddhism and begin to hear this talk about dukkha, right? There's all this suffering in life. It's like, what a downer. You know, why would you be interested in that? Well, and of course the answer is by learning to study the process of how the mind creates suffering, how it causes it, and then there's this astounding relinquishment of the suffering. It just goes away sometimes. It vanishes. It nirvanas. It's, you know, the white poker, the white-hot poker dropped into the cold water of relinquishment. And the suffering goes away. And then with that comes the capacity to be loving, compassionate, joyful. It's the great liberation. But I know in my own my own naivete and silliness when I started practice, I really had the what I now refer to as the puff of smoke mentality about getting enlightened. I was going to practice hard, and when the merry-go-round got to the brass ring, I was going to grab the brass ring, and I was going to be then enlightened, and there would be a puff of smoke, and everyone would live happily. I at least was quite self-centered. I would live happily ever after. That's the Hinayana model, right? Which is where we all begin. But then gradually, ever so slowly, as growing up is happening, it becomes more and more obvious that that's not what it's about at all. It's really about learning how to be more loving. How to be kinder in our activities with each other, following the precepts, not because one should, but because it feels better, because it makes one happier. So this path of liberation and compassion is really one of joy and happiness. So I wish we had the time to now have sharing and discussion for an afternoon or a weekend, but we don't. And so what I'd like to do instead, we have another few minutes, is if you'd, let's first, be, without moving, be aware of how you're sitting. Here you are in your earth suit. This is your vehicle through this human lifetime. It's an educational vehicle. And now let's bring it from sitting to standing, but ever so mindfully. Noticing its every nuance, its every sensation, the change of shape as you go. Four great postures of mindfulness practice: sitting, standing, walking, and lying down. Standing and knowing it. Breathing. And in this breathing, knowing that we share this process of breathing with everything that lives on the planet. And let's now, to the degree that you're comfortable with it, and if you don't want to, don't feel pressured, let your hands reach out and find someone to hold hands with on left and right, if you can, if you have both. Notice the moment of contact. In the vastness of space, there's another human or humans to make contact with. And now between these two hands stands a mortal being capable of being a Buddha, at root a Buddha. And also capable of feeling very isolated and separate and vulnerable and subject to all forms of suffering. And so let's imagine. And if there's a particular suffering in your life, use that. Let's imagine that we breathe that suffering into our hearts. And that this is the heart of the Buddha or the Great Mother. We breathe it into the heart and then breathe back, may I be free from this suffering or attachment to this suffering. So we transmute this suffering into love, kindness. And now feeling the hand of the person to your left and giving it a little squeeze because it's quite personal. You may know this person or you may not, but you know certainly that they have a great deal of experience of dukkha. They face, before the end of this lifetime, saying goodbye to everything and everything that they love. And so let's breathe from them, from all their suffering, into our own hearts. May they be freed from this, and then breathing back, may you be deeply happy, content. May you remember your great nature. Notice there's someone on your left who is reaching out in the most deep possible way they can, connecting with our interbeing and wishing you well. And now let's change the polarity to the person on our right now. Give their hand a little squeeze or a little stroke. It's a precious hand, isn't it? Bony inside, soft on the outside, vulnerable. You know that she or he suffers mightily and will more. You know that she or he suffers from a case of mistaken identity, just like we all do. And so taking their suffering now, the person on your right, into your heart, the heart of the transformative Buddha, and breathing back, may you be free from all this suffering. May your practice go deep. May you remember your great nature. Breathing in and breathing out. Notice there's someone on your left now. Some of us have difficulty imagining that someone might really love us. Someone on your left who's wishing you very well. And let's now extend out this through this circle of hands and across through the little gaps to everyone in this room. And let's include Gil and Tamara and Torin and all the other members of your community here, our community that aren't here. We breathe all the suffering, all the fear, all the loneliness, all the sickness, mental illness, we breathe it into our hearts. We don't shy away, and we offer back, may these beings be deeply content and happy. All of us who gathered here tonight to do this marvelous way of being together. And let's now extend this outwards to our children and grandchildren and partners, spouses, parents, grandparents, relatives. We're far from powerless. We breathe the suffering into the heart of the Buddha and send back the greatest wish that we know, whatever that is for you. And touch in with the hands to your left and right at some moments and notice, here we are together. And because we're aware of the great tragedy of identification with the small self that's happening in the Middle East, let's bring to our hearts Ariel Sharon, a man with a very complicated and painful lifetime, frightened, angry, breathing into our hearts all of his suffering. And breathing back a moment, perhaps he could have just a moment of feeling safe in the world and tranquil and cared about and loving. He's doing what he thinks best, given his conditioning. Breathing in, suffering. Breathing out, great blessing. And his partner in this great madness, Yasser Arafat, trapped in his little rooms, frightened, belligerent, scared, angry, breathing his suffering. Perhaps you can see his face, you imagine it, breathing it into your heart. Oh, may all this sadness and fear and ungrieved grief come home to the heart of the Buddha and the Mother and then go back. May he feel loved, protected, for a moment inexplicably safe. We breathe in suffering and breathe out great blessings. And so now to all the frightened, angry, identified with their thoughts, Israelis and Palestinians. And all the frightened, angry, suffering from ignorance, Americans and Saudis and Chileans and Africans, all of us humans, just barely emerging into consciousness as a species, breathing in all this ignorance, all this blind lust and hatred, and breathing back great blessings. May all beings be free from suffering. May all beings remember their own true great nature. And also all of our animal and bird and friends of the air, earth and waters. We're all in this together, trying to find our way home. And let's now come again to these feet and these hands to our left and right. And let's let our eyes open now and to look around with what I like to call the eyes of blessing, which are with the thought, may you be deeply happy and content. May you be free from suffering. My brothers and my sisters. And noticing that we're standing and breathing and seeing, no need not to be mindful. In fact, how much better to know that we're here. Little nodes of consciousness and heart looking outwards, seeing. And let's for a minute chant the great primary sound, Om, and we'll end with a gong. So let's now mindfully relinquish these hands. Don't let them go all of a sudden. Realize this is...
You did already. Back.
I know it's late. We got to go. But we have to hurry off somewhere to do something. Standing and holding hands, and then ever so mindfully, we may never hold this hand again. We never know. So letting it part with great consciousness. So let us offer one another a bow in our apparent separateness. I thank you for your presence and your participation and your welcoming Nancy and me here. And I invite you, you probably don't all know each other, please introduce yourself at least to the persons on your left and right, particularly if you don't know them.